Hello, everybody, and welcome to Kentucky Ag Matters, a podcast designed to inform and educate both producers and consumers about all matters affecting agriculture. Special thanks to WKDZ, your Ag Edge Network, for their help in bringing you this show. On this week's show, David, Jay, and Vicki will visit with Dr. Greg Halich, UK Ag Extension Economist, to discuss bale grazing. Our weekly topic will be surviving high input costs during 2022. And as always, we will wrap things up with this week's timely tip. Thanks so much for joining us. We hope you enjoy the show. Well, hello, everybody.
Hey, Jay.
David, how are you doing today?
I'm getting along. A little damp.
A little damp?
Yeah.
It's a lot damp.
I think anywhere you go in the eastern part of the United States right now, from the Mississippi River to the East Coast, you're going to experience some form of precipitation, whether it's if you're below the Ohio River, it might be ice, it might be rain. If you're above the Ohio River, it's hopefully snow and you can escape all this ice mess. So
we've had a lot of fluctuations in the temperature, too.
It's changed quite a bit. I saw something earlier this week. It said I'm prepared for the week. It said I've got my sunscreen. I've got my flip-flops. I've got my toboggan. I've got my mittens. I'm ready for the Kentucky weather for this
week.
That's
right. So that's right.
That's kind of the way it's been. Well, we want to welcome everybody to this week's episode. This will be our sixth show in our series so far, and our guest today that's going to sit down with us is Dr. Greg Halich. He's Extension Ag Economist with University of Kentucky, and he's going to be here today to talk with us about a topic that has become really quite popular here recently, and that's bale grazing. David, I know you're actually doing some of this, and I hope you can weigh in some of this too. Me and Vicki might just be along for the ride, or we might weigh in at some point. But
that'd be fine.
Greg, welcome to our show.
It's good to be here. Also a fun time to be feeding cattle with all this rain.
Isn't it, though?
You know, I've not had cattle myself since 1992. But when I think back to all the years of having cattle, and I think of wet winters like this, and I think of those temperature fluctuations that Vicki was talking about, personally, I would rather have it not raining. And maybe 20 degrees. I'd just soon the ground be froze, and it'd be a lot easier, not only easier on the person, but I think it's easier on the animals, not slopping around in all that mud and thinking about all the calories that they're wasting just trying to get back and forth between water and the hay ring.
Yeah, you know, that's the thing about it, Jay, is right now it's an awful time right now, but, Greg, we've talked a lot off the air and different times about bale grazing. Talk to us a little bit about what this system is all about.
So very simply, you know, think of rotational grazing, but instead of grazing the pasture, you're setting hay out. That's going to be your pasture, kind of in checkerboard fashion. And just like with the rotational grazing, you will use temporary fencing, polywire, polytape, and you will move that, you know, anywhere from every 1 to every 7 days, depending on, you know, how many cattle you have and how many bales that you're giving them at a time. But from that point, it's very similar to rotational grazing.
What is, in your opinion, what would be one of the biggest goals of bale grazing? Is it distribution of nutrients? Is it keeping from treading up pastures? What would be one of the overlying goals that you hope to accomplish?
So maybe the primary benefits is...
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I usually try to think or tell people, there are many smaller benefits maybe, but the three primary benefits to me, number one would be increasing your fertility of your pastures or even potentially hay ground, although I would urge you to start on pastures for a few years. That's probably the one that most people think of, and it, again, depending on your situations, it probably will be the biggest benefit. But second one is just, you know, if you set this up right, if you implement it well, and it may take a few years to get to that point, it may take 3 years to get to that point, but I've seen farms that have easily reduced their winter tractor use by 90% or greater. And then the third benefit, and this is something that I finished cattle on pasture. I don't have a cow-calf operation, and so it wasn't really until I started working with cow-calf operations that I really noticed this third benefit. But by the end of the first year, out of everyone that I've ever worked with bale grazing on a cow-calf operation, every one of them have, by the end of that first winter, have said something like, you know, I can't believe how clean the cow stayed the entire winter. And so basically, because you're moving those cattle to fresh ground, even if it's once a week, they are always going to have somewhere dry to lay down. And, you know, cattle are not stupid. If they have a dry place, they're going to use it. We can talk about that topic just by itself in terms of how much of a benefit that is your cattle. It's hard to quantify in terms of the reduced energy that they would otherwise need going through that mud, just physically pushing through it. But even just what the mud does to the hair coat and what that does to reduce insulating qualities, that sort of thing. But there are just so many benefits to not having your cattle, particularly think about little calves. You know, fortunately, I've never experienced any farms I work with bale grazing, but I can't tell you how many presentations I've done where someone will come up to me afterwards and said, you know, yeah, I dragged out X number of calves this last year out of the mud. By the way, I think the record I've heard is around 12 or 13. I mean, I just can't imagine doing that. So a lot of benefits, but those are what I would call the three primary ones.
You know, one benefit you mentioned right there, I think we'll talk about later as we get into this week's topic of surviving 2022, but when you talk about the decreased tractor usage, and I'm thinking about diesel fuel prices right now, that would have to be one of those fluctuating benefits that changes from time to time. But with a year like this, that would be a big deal.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously the direct cost is diesel fuel, but just think about, you know, the wear and tear on your machinery, particularly in the wintertime. You know, I don't care if you're just running it for 15 minutes. You start that tractor in cold weather, most of that wear occurs, you know, the first 10 seconds, and you start that thing up. So, yes, but particularly right now, yeah, it's going to hurt if you're out there every day.
You know, one of the things that really caught my attention, Greg, I saw you do lots of, several times, the bale grazing presentation, and then what struck me finally was the whole term about extending your grazing season. And to me, that is one advantage that I think is probably second to none. The field that we actually calve in every year, we're in there for, when we used to do it the way we used to do it, which was we'd strip graze 3 days every paddock, and then we'd move. So every third day, they were getting new grass. This year with the bale grazing, we're getting 7 days in each paddock. We went from 21 days to 42 days, and we're still in there. You know, we came in there about the middle of January. So, you know, to me, extending that grazing season is probably one of the best benefits that I can think of amongst all the other ones. It's a really good one.
You know, I've always been told that a day you're not feeding hay is a day you're helping your bottom line, you know, and, you know, I guess from that standpoint alone, you know, just that one change can make a difference.
Yeah, it really does. And you know, it's in this case, you're actually feeding hay, but you're probably not feeding as much as you'd be feeding if you were feeding nothing but hay.
Right. That's the point I was making. Yeah.
Right. You didn't have the stockpile grass, you know, and that's the great thing about this system is you can still stockpile grass and still do this system and still extend that grazing period. And, I mean, it just keeping those cows clean. And the only time that I have had problems was when we had the ice. And to be able to have something for those calves, the baby calves, to bed down on, that has been my only issue. People say, well, they didn't want to unroll that hay or something for those calves, and it was a little muddy, but yet I saved those calves, and a dead calf doesn't sell very good in the fall. So to me, you know, saving those calves is priority number one, but, you know, being able to do that was the only time I had any problem. We've had lots of rain, and we've had lots of other stuff go on, but I didn't have any trouble with keeping the cows clean, keeping the calves clean. They had good grass the whole time. And the other thing that I've noticed, the cows don't eat the grass down as we're moving every 7 days. They're not eating it in the ground like they were if we were doing it every 3 days.
So theoretically, you're going to have quicker pasture recovery in the spring.
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, don't you, Greg? I mean, don't you think that would be a benefit from some standpoint? That could be a benefit.
Yeah, and I have a little feedback on here. I think so in areas. So I don't want to say definitively on this. So what I will say is pastures that are bale grazed, you'll have some areas right around what I call the impact zone where the bales are being fed that are going to be set back somewhat. But farther away from there, I actually think that you may have a little bit earlier spring grip because you're getting nutrients from, you know, from the hay kind of being distributed. Most of them are going to, or a higher percentage is going to be right around that ring, but the cattle are walking around. They're spreading the manure in your and other areas. So yeah, you'll have a little bit of both. So I don't know. Long run, I guess to me is even more important. Long run on those pastures, they will green up earlier. Once you kind of get all those, once you get those pastures really up to speed where the fertility is kind of kicking in, long run, those pastures are going to be greening up like you've never seen.
And with fertilizer prices, if what they are right now, you know, being able to put those nutrients back on, and Greg, you can discuss some of this, you know, how much nutrient value does a roll of hay have, and how much, you know, how much fertilizer savings can folks expect with some of this stuff?
And I haven't done that analysis with the current fertilizer prices. And, you know, if we really want to be fair, you know, that value can be zero if you're feeding in a dry lot, versus if you're, and by the way, I love unrolling. If my only option is unrolling, feeding in a sacrifice lot, feeding on a feeding pad, or even a feeding barn, I'm going to unroll every day of the week. The only thing I don't like about unrolling is, you know, if you're going to minimize waste, you're going to do it probably every day or at most, or at least every 2 days. And you're also going to have it means you're going to be running a tractor probably more than you would if you're feeding in those other alternatives. And, you know, right now you're going to be running up your pastures trying to get out there. So there's a few things I don't like about unrolling, but the nutrient distribution that you get is great. And so I do like that. Bale grazing kind of has the best of both worlds. You're not out there with a tractor when you shouldn't be. If you do it right, you can sit out a third or more of your hay at one time in increments. So you move a lot of hay in a short period of time, and then you're not out there for a long period. One of the farms I worked with or still work with, you know, they set out over 100 days of hay at one time. Didn't have it. It was on a farm that was 5 miles from the home farm. They never had to bring a tractor out there for the bulk of the winter. So a number of benefits, and I think I'm getting away from the original question, which was what now?
About kind of talk with us about, you know, the value of the hay, you know, the value of the nutrients that are in the hay.
It depends entirely on how you feed it out. So if you unroll or you're bale grazing, you're getting, you know, probably 90% of the nutrients that are in that hay, and not all of it's going to be immediately available to the plant. Some of it, you know, basically anything in the manure that's in the organic matter that's going to be released over time. What's in the urine is essentially going to be available that first year. And by the way, the bulk of the nitrogen, about 2/3 of the nitrogen and 90% of the potassium is going to be in the urine. And so all that, or the bulk of that, is going to be available that first year. And then the rest of the nutrients kind of available over time. So I'm not giving you exact number, you know, and I almost hate to give you a number with the current fertilizer price because, you know, hopefully they don't stay this high for that long. But what I would say is even if they stay at, say, you know, nitrogen at 40 cents a unit, potassium at 35, 40 cents a unit, we're still probably talking at least $20 to $30 of fertilizer value per ton in that hay, if not more. That would be a low end estimate. Versus again, if you're feeding in a dry lot, even a feeding pad, you're getting very little of that back. In a feeding pad, you're getting the bulk of the, if you are spreading it, you're getting the bulk of the manure. But again, you're losing almost 100% of the potassium. You're losing 2/3 of the nitrogen right off the bat, and that's assuming that you get that under cover so you don't lose more of that nitrogen that's in that manure. So, again, kind of with typical price, I would say probably somewhere between $20 to $35 a ton. So 2 5x5 bales, about a ton.
Yep. You know, and when we were talking about unrolling hay, Greg, you know, if the ground got froze, like Jay said, and it stayed froze, it'd be a lot better option. But the bale grazing to me is allows us to do that without having to be out there every day with our tractor and unrolling hay.
That's right.
So, I mean, that's to me it. And then also you have a kind of a special concoction of seed that you go around and kind of sow those spots down with. Talk to us a little bit about how you do that, when you do it, kind of what the concoction is.
And you will, and let me say this, you will definitely have damage on a good percentage of your rolls by the end of the wintertime. So if it's frozen, if it's dry, you'll have very little damage around the ring. But, you know, this winter, I would say that's what, maybe a 25% of the time at most. Yeah. And so, you know, this winter, you know, probably two-thirds of what I call the impact zone, the area right around that. So imagine where they're being fed with that hay ring. Inside of that's going to have very little damage. If you're using poor quality hay, you might have a lot of waste in there that will choke out growth. But if, assuming you've got decent quality hay, you won't have enough, or you shouldn't have enough waste in there to even choke out the growth that next spring. But the area around that, so think of a donut kind of area around that hay ring. That's what I call the impact zone. That's where the cattle are standing when they're eating at that ring of hay. And if it's wet, yeah, you're going to have damage in there. You're going to have compaction. So be prepared for that. But realize that's going to be a small percentage of the overall area in that pasture. If you're feeding, you know, I like to say keep bale grazing at 2 tons of hay to the acre or less. That's essentially 2 tons is going to be 4 5x5 bales to the acre. So we're talking about a small area. But that said, I still like to get growth on that as quick as I can that next spring. So yeah, I've experimented with various you know, forage species in that seeding mix. And what I in general like to tell people is you want something that's going to provide quick cover. I call that the pioneer species. Something like Italian ryegrass, annual ryegrass. I've experimented a little bit with oats. Not enough to say definitively that those work great, but I think oats would work good. And then what you want is something that will also break the compaction. So to me, this is key, because what I found here to break through that compaction is foraged chicory and plantain, foraged plantain. When I say chicory, people raise their eyebrows and they think about the wild chicory that's in their pastures, which, by the way, that's not a bad thing, because even that wild chicory has a very deep taproot, very strong taproot. And that typically is there for a reason. It's probably saying there's some compaction in your pasture, and it's probably long run doing a job there. But yeah, the wild chicory doesn't provide a lot of leaves for the cattle to eat. The foraged chicory is completely different. You will see a lot of leaves on that. It generally doesn't bolt until late in the first year. So it's a different animal. But to me, its main job is to break up the compaction, just like the plantain. But the foraged chicory actually is incredible. Forage cattle, when they go into the bale grazed areas after, you know, it's gotten up, say by late June, early July, that will be their first preferential species when they graze that pasture. They'll go around the bale grazed areas, eat all the chicory and some of the plantain. Then when the chicory's gone, they'll eat the plantain. Only at that point will they touch the clover. They love that stuff so much they'll eat it before the clover.
Drag those places? Do you and when do you do that? I mean, do you try to work it in, or what do you?
I personally do not drag, do not harrow, but I'm not saying some farms shouldn't do that. So what I will say is this: if you in the past have just based on your management, if you don't have good biological activity going on those pastures, if you don't have a lot of dung beetles, if you've used a lot of chemical fertilizer, and if you've sprayed a lot of herbicide, your biological life in that cell is going to be at a low level compared to what it could be. So in farms where that's the case, where the biology isn't that good, those manure pats are going to take a long time to break down. So maybe in that situation, you need to do it for a while. But where you've got good soil biology, nature will take care of that in the first month of the growing season. I would offer, you know, bet if you can come out to my farm and mark a couple pats during the wintertime and come back by early May if they're still there, I'll give you $20 per one that you can find. They're gone. They're completely gone.
Yeah. Well, I've got my plantain, and I'm working on getting my chicory, so I'm gonna give this a shot.
And then mix in just whatever else you want in the pasture long run, so orchard grass, clover, that sort of thing. But whatever you want long run, mix in with it, and you've got a good mixer. And I generally do that just late winter, so about the time, you know, right, and typically I just do it all at one time, but you could you know, I know some of the farms, they just kind of do it while they're going along.
Yeah, I wondered that. I didn't know if you needed to do it and kind of get it treaded in, or if you just needed to kind of wait until they got out there.
Yeah. I usually wait until I'm just the last week that they're actual bale grazing or so end of March or beginning of April. I'll personally, that's when I'll go out and reseed those areas. But it wouldn't hurt to do it before that. It's just kind of with all the other things I have going on, it typically doesn't happen until about that point.
Yeah, and it's going to be interesting. I'm very excited about trying it and seeing how it works and all that kind of. I'm really pleased with the bale grazing. I set out enough hay for 42 days in a couple of hours. And then the other day I went, and we're still 2 weeks from moving to another field. And I went out and set out enough for another 2 weeks. So I've got enough hay almost to the end of March set out already. So I'm very excited. It's working good. I like it. The only problem we have locally is the ice. When we have the ice with the baby calves, I mean, that's my only thing. If I was doing stockers, or if I just had cows that weren't calving, would be no problem, you know. But with the baby calves, I always like to try to at least have them something to bed down on when we have the ice, you know, just to. It makes me feel better. It makes me sleep better at night, Greg. So that it may not have any added value whatsoever, but for me, I can sleep better at night when it's like that.
So, David, are you saying you just did not have enough waste in the hay that had been fed out for the calves to bed on?
Right. That's okay. Exactly right. Yeah.
That's not necessarily a bad problem either.
Right. And I was going to ask you to talk a little bit about that. Talk about the quality of the hay that you're going to need to set out and not setting out, you know, what to set out and what not to set out.
Well, I mean, generally, you're going to have to set out what you have. And, right. And obviously, the better quality you have in an ideal world, the less waste you're going to have. Mm-hmm. But I've seen it work with everything from, you know, poor quality to great quality. You're going to have a lot more waste, just like you'll have in, you know, if you're feeding conventionally, if the quality is poor. So I'm not sure if I can answer that question fully. Obviously, the better quality, but... Yeah, this isn't the perfect world, though. You can make it work with lower, you know, less than ideal quality.
Yeah, you're just going to – I mean, to me, when you have lesser quality hay, you have more hay waste, and then you have bigger piles left after you move, and that will infringe a little bit on your regrowth unless you have a way to spread that out or something, you know. So that's just kind of the point I was
trying to get at. Yeah, and I got it now, and I understand the point. And yes, so if you – versus if that was in a feeding pad or dry lot, you're not worrying about. So, yes, what David is saying is in the middle of your hay ring, you know, that's where your waste is going to be. And then you move that hay ring to the next bale, and then you're feeding again. But what he's saying is, yeah, the poor quality hay, you're going to have a thick thatch of waste hay there that definitely will choke out the, you know, the forage that was in that circle. Will kill it out probably if it's thick enough. But again, think about how many of that area on an acre base. So four bales per acre, it's pretty small. So I wouldn't worry about that so much from that standpoint. But to me, again, in an ideal world, we all have great quality hay. But
well, I think that's just one of those things that each, you know, there's not two farms alike. And it's, and I think that's probably like when you said in the beginning that sometimes it takes 1, 2, 3 years to figure out what's going to work best for your farm and what works best for you, and probably figure it out. You know, each producer themselves will figure out, well, this hay is going to be better to do this, and let's not, maybe not this, or let's save this till last.
Yep.
And it's just kind of like a trial and error to figure out.
Another good point
best.
to go ahead and test your hay so you know what your hay is, so you know what you're feeding, you know, and you need to be feeding your best quality hay when your cows are calving. Obviously, and poor quality hay is when they're, you know, in their lactation, the last part of lactation or mid gestation, whatever. But, you know, for sure, during that first couple of months, 2-3 months, you need to be feeding the best hay that you have to those cows.
Right, and save that lower quality hay for the time in between birth and those early milking days.
Right.
And when you're trying to get ready to rebreed so that you're getting back into good nutrition. And
yeah, you know, the nutritional meat and the nutritional needs. And the hay that we're feeding right now is about 10% protein, 51% TDN, plus they've got to stockpile grass. And to me, that's what makes up the nutritional needs that they have.
And let me add to that, because I was actually just going to make that comment, because I'm not sure if maybe the listeners probably fully understood when David was talking earlier about his system. But David essentially is he's bale grazing on stockpiled pasture. So in other words, he's starting to feed hay before he runs out of pasture. Yeah. He's bale grazing before he gets to that point. And I've found, you know, it took me about 4 or 5 years to figure that on my own, but it finally clicked on me. You know, why am I going through all my pasture then setting out all my hay bale grazing? Why not combine the two? And one thing I found, not so much on my farm, again, I finish cattle and I have a really good hay supplier. I mean, I can pretty much guarantee it's going to be 14 to 15% every year. You know, I pay for it. Mm-hmm. But I just came from a farm. I'm not going to say where it was, but I came from a farm, but that I would be shocked if this hay is better than 6% protein. Mm-hmm. Now, what David is saying, though, is if you feed that poor quality hay in with good quality stockpile, you've just essentially given yourself a supplement. So yep. Use that stockpile to advantage. In other words, you can mix your poor quality hay in with that stockpile at the right time when maybe they don't need it to bump up their nutritional requirements, and then maybe feed your best quality hay when you're just feeding it by itself. Mm-hmm. So yeah. That's a tool. That's another tool
absolutely.
That you can use.
Yes. And that's another good reason to know what your hay is, you know, and you can't, there's no way to know unless you test it. And, you know, I've had people tell me a lot of times when they're trying to sell you hay, I said, well, it's green. It smells good. Well, yeah, it may do it, but that's really no, you know, there's no way to know what it's going to test. I mean, I've seen some really green hay that smelled really good that didn't test very well. So, you know, knowing what your hay test is really important, and being able to set out your best quality hay during that period that their nutritional needs are the highest is pretty important. So, you know, for my first year doing it, Greg, I'm pretty pleased, yeah. And I appreciate you doing the work ahead of time to figure out all the things I didn't need to do, plus what I didn't do to begin with, you know, has really made a big impact on our operation for sure.
It's great to hear that. Let me add one more comment, because I agree. I mean, it's, you know, I think most of us with some experience can visually look, you know, if there's a lot of leaf in that hay, it's going to be better quality, et cetera. But I'll tell you who knows quality of hay, and that's the cattle. And one nice thing about feeding on the stockpile is just watching what the cattle do will tell me the quality of hay. So, for instance, if I'm typically moving, let's say, every 4 days, typically, let's say that they're getting, let's just say, a third of their diet from the stockpile, two-thirds from the hay, they're going to hit the stockpile pretty hard, at least early in the year. And by the way, you know, the quality of that stockpile declines. So over time with the same hay, if the cattle start, and typically the cattle will always go to the stockpile at least for 10, 15 minutes. If nothing else, I think they like to exercise something different. But if they then move to the hay when there's still plenty of stockpile, that's telling me the quality of that stockpile has gone down and the hay is actually better at that mm-hmm. point. But if it, you know, this doesn't happen a lot, but if it's early in the season, the cattle are, and you've got good stockpile and two or, you know, maybe 20, 30% of the cattle are immediately still going to the hay, that's telling you you've got good quality hay there.
Yeah.
So.
I think part of my, and I've noticed that, exactly what you're talking about. For 10, 15 minutes, they'll graze, and you can tell the stockpile there at my house is, a lot of it's really brown, and its quality has really gone down, and so, you know, I think that is a really good point, and I think that's true, very true. So, but Jay, we've got another topic we want to talk about and move right on into, and it's talking about our inputs and how we're going to survive 2022. And Greg, we want you to chime in on this. You know, we've talked about supply chain issues. We've talked about high fertilizer prices, high chemical prices, the lack of chemicals and all those things. You know, how are we going to survive that?
Sure. You know, you and I were talking before the show about this, and you mentioned the two big ones right there. You mentioned high fertilizer prices, not only the high prices, but availability of some of those products. Same way with our chemicals. You know, availability may be as much of an issue as the high price is. Something you and I both discussed before we started taping is our fuel cost. Diesel fuel right now, well, again, higher than it was a year ago at this time. And we're at a time where that's only fixing to ramp up and the need is going to get a lot greater. We've got a lot more instabilities in the world right now this week that we didn't necessarily have to deal with last week. that are all going to add to the, that increase in oil prices. So I think when everybody's talking about chemicals and talking about fertilizer, I think we can lump our fuel prices, any energy prices, in, into that just as well. So, Greg, how do you see this outlook right now? With we talk about it being a year that folks just need to make it through. And that may be as big a point as any, but we are, there are some strategies with fertilizer prices and whatnot that that folks can do to do a little better than just survive, hopefully.
So you're asking for my thought here?
Sure, sure.
So that I guess there are two trains of thought. One in terms of the, and I guess quick question: are we talking all farmers or just cattle farmers or what?
We think all farmers. All farmers. And there, okay, again, right before the show, David and I were discussing the difference between livestock producers right now and a grain producer in the spring. We know perpetually that most pastures do not receive the fertility that they should. But if you're talking about a grain farmer, if he's not fertilizing, he's not making a crop. So, talk to both, but whichever you'd prefer to, sure, start with.
Let me just start with grain farming because I think it's a quick discussion. So, yeah, in terms of high fertilizer price, you're going to hit grain farmers the hardest. But, you know, you can contract corn for delivery next fall, not even winter, but for fall, for $6 a bushel now. And beans, I and the market tanked today on beans and a little bit on corn, but I think still well over $15 a bushel for, right, for next fall. So, of course, you don't need much. You need no nitrogen typically for soybeans and not quite as much P and K. So let me just say this, you know, and I do a little bit of grain farming, but I know farmers like to complain that, let me rephrase that. Farmers like to point out when fertilizer prices are high. And so I'm just talking grain farming here right now. But let me assure you, and again, I do enough grain farming on my own to push the pencil hard, and a big part of my job is working with grain farmers. So, yes, they would be a whole lot more profitable in this upcoming year, fertilizer price, but with corn where it's at price-wise and where beans are at price-wise, believe me, they're going to have a good year this year compared to their average. In fact, they're going to have one of their most profitable years ever if prices stay anywhere close to where they are. There's a lot of risk there, right? They're going to have a lot of input costs going in. So it may be a year that you really want to hedge more of your crop than you typically would for that reason. In other words, if markets tank by fall and you have all that input costs going in, yeah, it's going to hit you hard. But with where you can contract right now, grain farmers are going to have a really good year this upcoming year.
You know, one of your predecessors years ago used to talk about hedging at least 50% of that crop and then maybe banking 50% to see what prices are going to be like at that time. Would you think now that it might be the time to look at being well north of 50% of that crop as far as contracting goes?
So I'm not going to claim to be a grain marketer. I mean, I do a little bit of that on my own. All I would say is whatever you typically have hedged this time, whether we're talking right now or once you get it planted, given where input prices are, I would definitely have a higher percentage of that crop hedged than what I would normally do. Let me say this. I realize a lot of farmers got burned last year about hedging early and then with the price increase. I understand that. Psychologically, once that happens, it's hard to – it's hard not to remember that kind of sting that you got there. But let me just say, this year is a good time to hedge a bigger portion of your crop. I don't know if I certainly wouldn't recommend, say, 50% at this point, but maybe by once it's in the ground, maybe 50% at that point.
I think it's a safe point to remind those people who got stung last year, they're going to have a lot higher input costs this year as well, and being able to protect those, anything you can do to merge against that, it would be advisable.
Sure.
Yeah, and, you know, this year is not like last year. It's not going to be like next year. You know, we've got to do some different things every year probably as far as marketing goes. But, you know, I think Greg's right. I mean, with the way the prices are, you'd be kind of foolish is probably not a very good word, but you need to be doing something and have some kind of marketing plan going into this year for sure.
You're taking on a lot more risk this year by not hedging your crop given where input prices are. Yeah. Sure.
I think in general, you know, this year's like this, you know, like with these high input costs, I mean, I think you just have to be prepared. I think you just have to, I mean, yeah, we all know we need to be prepared every year, but, you know, I just think you need to be a little more prepared, a little plan maybe, you know, a little bit more this year. And I think that whether you're talking about grain producers or whether you're talking about, you know, livestock producers or even fruit and vegetables for that matter, across the board, I think one of the ways that we can help ourselves is soil testing. And I mean, because if you're guessing on what you're going to apply, you're guessing where you are, then you could be really, you know, putting a whole lot more fertilizer on than you need, or you could be hurting yourself on the other end and think you're in better shape than what you are. It's a dangerous game to play on guessing that, kind of like David, you were talking about on the hay side. It's kind of dangerous to guess. I mean, because it's hard to do that. I mean, we all think we know, but you know, I think that's one way. Know where our starting point is and then go from there, and then try to get more bang for your buck, so to speak, because you're applying what you need rather than just guessing on that part.
Sure. I don't think this year, Greg, is a year to guess on anything. I know every producer probably has a different level of risk that they're comfortable with. And if nothing else, knowing that level of risk that you're willing to work with to help you make some of these decisions.
Yeah. Let me make one quick comment before I forget about it. So I think number one, this is a year that you don't want to skimp on soil testing. But the comment I want to get to before I forget is, you know, we had two soil testing labs, University of Kentucky. One of them is gone now. So this is a year that you want to get your soil test in as quick as you can, because it is going to get delayed based on what I've heard. It's going to take a lot longer than normal.
So far, from my experience just there in Hopkins County, it's been just a little bit taller than a two-week turnaround, which is what they had anticipated. Not much more than that, but just a little more than 2 weeks. Okay.
We're really not in the busy season yet.
That's fixing to be my point, we're not quite yet to that point where most of those samples are going to be rolling into the lab. Yeah. And when that time comes, we're going to get behind pretty quick.
And the question you ask yourself, Greg, is when, you know, from an economic standpoint, when your soil tests are in the medium, maybe medium high or very high range, you know, do you try to farm a little bit of that out this year, or do you try to put on a minimal amount, or, you know, what do you think?
So before I answer that, let me go back just to one last, what I was trying to get to at the beginning. So number one, I think we almost want to divide between grain farming and cattle farming, because it's on a per acre base, it's going to hit grain farmers probably more, but given what they're going to sell their product for, again, they're going to have a really good year here, assuming that prices don't tank. Mm-hmm. So now to answer your question, if I'm a grain farmer, I don't necessarily want to skim, even if I'm in the close to the middle range, because if I lose a couple bushels, you know, that's $6 corn per bushel and $15 beans per bushel. So what I would say is be very careful there for a grain farmer. I think most people there understand that. Now, for a cattle farmer, though, on the other hand, and by the way, I think cattle farmers are the one that are really going to take it on the chin with these high fertilizer prices, especially if in terms of making hay, and you know, that's where the bulk of the fertilizer is probably going towards in terms of cattle farmers. So on hay ground, if I'm in the medium range or maybe even a little bit lower than medium range on my hay ground, might be a good year to, I guess the assumption here is that we're going to go back to normal prices. And I don't know that for sure, but if we are, and if you think that's the case, then this might be a good year to maybe not do no fertilizer but in terms of P&K, but maybe to reduce it quite a bit. And with the assumption that you're going to end up, say, 2, 3, 4 years from now, put more of it back to make up for that.
Yeah, you know, and lime is always a situation that we've got to address, and you know, to be able to go grow good grass, we've got to have our pH in line, and so we need to be thinking about, you know, is that where we want to spend our money maybe, or is if we're in the very high range, do we go on and put the lime on instead of spending money on fertilizer? I think is some of the questions that I've been getting there at the office. So
I've had discussions with several farmers over that too. Yep. And you know, my mind frame is, you know, we need to really get our soil pH right to really utilize the other nutrients that we're applying, because if we're not working on that, I feel like we need to really try to get that in line. And I think you can do a lot of good that way. Mm-hmm. Yep. I mean,
yeah, I think so.
Sounds good. Greg, anything else to add to that?
To
any part of it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Let me say this. In general, I guess there are two ways you can almost look at the. So I'm talking just purely cattle farmers right here when I talk about this, but there's almost two ways you could look at this. How do we get through these high fertilizer prices, which I think we're kind of talking about right now? In other words, what can we do immediately to kind of tweak what we're doing? The other way you can look at this is, how can I make major changes in my operations so that I'm not so reliant and dependent on commercial fertilizer? And I personally think that has a whole lot more possibilities, not just immediately, but long run, to improve the bottom line on cattle operations. And I personally, that's where I'm spending more of my effort, is not so much tweaking. Yeah, we need to do a lot more soil testing. We can kind of tweak when we're in that middle range in terms of P and K applications. But we're talking about, you know, we're not talking about hundreds of dollars an acre here. We're talking about $10, $20 an acre. So, and I'm not going to go through the details on this. I just did a presentation in Hardin County two nights ago, and I had the details. But on what I would call a conventional fertilizer regime for pasture and hay ground on cattle operation, the increase in fertilizer price on a per cow basis, so with that I'm talking about 2 acres of pasture and 1 acre of hay ground, the increase, not the overall cost, the increase on fertilizer is $175 per cow. So yeah, we can tweak these things and save 10 or 20 or 30 bucks. But folks, we got a much bigger hole to dig out of than that. So yeah, we need to do the stuff we've talked about. But the only way that we're going to dig out of that hole, if we're going to be there for a long time, is we need a completely different approach to getting our fertility on cattle operations.
We talked last week about profitability per cow. And this is just another point where you'd be looking at that.
And bale grazing is to me one of the three main ways that you can radically change your operation to not be relying on commercial fertilizer for a cattle operation.
Yeah, I mean, that's my goal with doing this whole thing, is to be able to get away from fertilizing my pastures. And we kind of got away from it this last fall by not putting on any nitrogen. And we had really good growth. We had a really good year, you know, had lots of rain, had timely rains, that kind of stuff. But that, to my goal, is to get away from putting on so much P and K and nitrogen, to be able to get the same amount of growth for that to happen. So, yeah, that's my goal.
Sounds good. Well, Greg, we appreciate you joining in on our conversations. One of the things we do at the end of each show is we kind of have a timely tip that we like to leave producers with. It's just something we change from week to week, and we try to make it relevant to that time of the year. Right now, we're in the late winter, getting ready to be in early spring, and our timely tip is for beef producers to be feeding a high mag mineral along with their grazing systems. You know, right now, we're ahead of the grazing system. We're not quite to that spring grass green up yet, and we just want to make one more push to remind people that we're in that time of the year now that you should be feeding your high mag mineral. Ideally, 2 to 3 weeks at a minimum before grass exposure. And then at least for another month after they're on that new grass. So,
yeah, I always encourage folks too to read the tag. You know, a lot of mineral is fed at a different rate, you know, and is supposed to be consumed at a different rate. Some are 3 ounces, some are 4 ounces. You know, it's all over the board. And be sure to feed a quality mineral. I know UK has some recommendations out there that we recommend, but you know, whatever mineral you're feeding, you know, try to feed a good quality mineral. That's the, you know, to me, is a take-home message for sure.
You know, you speak of quality, and the thing I think about, I think more along the lines of like copper, for instance, and making sure you feed a copper that's bioavailable, and not just have a lot of it, but there's a lot of types of coppers that aren't necessarily available to the cow. So, good tip. Well, we want to thank Greg this week for being part of our show. We want to thank the hosts for all the work that they've put in for this, the information, and we want to thank our listeners for joining in. We hope you've enjoyed our show, and we'll make plans to join us again next week for our next episode. Until then, remember, Kentucky Ag matters.